Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right. Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us for the greatest, or excuse me, I screwed it up. Good golly. Somebody get a professional on the air, for gosh sakes. Anyway, thanks for joining us for the most scintillating hour of finance radio. Got a great show planned for you, but I want to start off with saying that we got another great interview coming up. It's going to be a little bit different, not quite as long this time. You won't have to go to the podcast afterwards. But a lot of crazy stuff going on in the world. Probably don't need to tell you that. You're watching the evening news. You're seeing it. Probably not paying as close attention to the economic side of it. But that's what we're going to do today. So we got our good friend, Chase Taylor, good friend of the show. Head of Pinecone Macro Research. Really smart macroeconomic researching firm out there that we utilize. We're a client of theirs. And got him to agree to come on the show. He's going to give us a global economic update. Great guy, great research, and just very valuable. It gets us past the noise, right? If you're watching TV, if you're at home, what you're probably hearing is, oh my goodness, the world's caving in, the sky's falling on one side, and on the other side, it's never been better, the economy's rolling, right? It's hyperbole on both sides. It always is. And one of the things I love talking to Chase is, you know, in this business, we say on the show all the time, our job is to get it right. Our job is not to be a proponent of one ideology or another. Our job is not to act as an agent for one, you know, one set of ideology or one set of, you know, opinions or anything like that. The job is to make money. The job is to get it right. So Chase really helps us do that. And, I think that's going to be a valuable resource for you guys to hear what he has to say. I know he's watching this stuff like a hawk. But anyway, before we get to that, now we've got it. That's going to happen in the second half of the show. I think that interview is about 30 minutes long. So we're going to do kind of an extended market update because we got a lot of stuff to cover. But first, just looking at the markets, what's going on? And I know that this has created a lot of questions with our clients. We've got many different portfolios that we run, but primarily we have a value-based fund that invests in what we think are undervalued companies, kind of the traditional Warren Buffett approach. Most of our clients don't have that just because we kind of reserve that for accredited investors. Just because, you know, anytime you're investing in individual stocks, even though we're very conservative about how we go after it, you want to be careful. But anyway, we've had a lot of questions because this year we have underperformed. So far this year, we've underperformed the market on that side of it. Kind of drastically. Now, we outperformed last year. We had a good year last year, especially as it relates to the market. Not so much this year. And clients, rightfully so, have been asking us, Zach, what's going on? Is something wrong in that portfolio? And I go, no. What's happened? Again, I on the journalistic side or just on the voyeuristic side, just kind of watching markets, it's really entertaining and really exciting because you're seeing all of these historic things happen at one time or the other. And even though you've seen this big run-up in the stock market this year, let's keep in mind that it's rebounding from the bloodbath of last year, okay? So we still haven't gone anywhere. We're still trading at the same levels or slightly above, depending on where we finish today, where we were last January. Okay, so we still haven't had that movement yet. We're still in this trading range. The interesting thing is, though, is that this year, even though the indexes have bounced back really big, if you take a look at it, and you can notice this, but pull up a Netflix, pull up Google, pull up Amazon, pull up a, fill in the CRM, Salesforce.com, right? Pull up the vast majority of the lead horses through this entire run-up of the last 10 years. And you'll see them trading substantially off their highs, which is interesting because then you're looking at the market and going, wait a second, how is the market making new highs if some of its biggest players, if some of the drivers of the advance, you haven't been participating? And at first glance, when I hear that, I start rubbing my hands together excited because, again, as a value guy that's focused on value stocks, what that means typically is that we've seen a rotation out of more of the momentum names and value's getting a bid. But that's not what's happened. As a matter of fact, the underperformance of value type stocks, it was historically long. We were in the longest stretch of underperformance of value stocks compared to growth stocks in recorded history. And then this year looks to be a crescendo. It's gone even further that way, and it's gone drastically that way, where value stocks have done nothing, and a lot of them are actually down. And it's not on bad news. It's not like anything's gone wrong with the stock. You know, the narrative hasn't changed. It's not like you get nervous. You know, you're not reading bad quarterly reviews. A lot of them did better, beat expectations. Stocks still went down. Okay, so then you're left scratching your head going, well, then how are the indexes going up? And I'll tell you exactly how the indexes are going up. This market move and this market upside. Now, look, I've been saying it for months, no, or years, actually. Nobody knows which way the market's going to go at any given time. Okay, nobody can tell you with any credibility whatsoever where this market's top is going to be. Okay, they just can't. But the interesting thing about this is this run-up is all based on multiple expansion on very speculative stocks. And we've been talking about this a long time. You've seen the IPOs that have come out. Beyond Meat, I want to say, is up somewhere like 400% in the last month. Okay, no new numbers came out. It's crazy. It makes no sense. That's the vegan burger patty. Zoom Technologies, same way. Good company, apparently a good product. Valuation is just insanity. Stock's gone up 300%, 400%. Don't quote me, but something like that. I think it IPO'd at 25. Today it's like 102. You've got the Chewy.com. Online pet store kind of reminds you of Pets.com from the late 90s. That IPO today, it's up 60, 70%. If you IPO, you're going up by 80 to 90, 100% in the first day. I haven't seen a run like this on IPOs since 99. As a matter of fact, this is by far the hottest IPO market we've had since 1999. That makes a lot of people excited. Makes me very nervous because those stocks, they cannot support those valuations. I'm not going to tell you to sell them. I'm not going to tell you to buy them. I'm not going to tell you to short them. You need to consult a financial advisor. That's not my job. What I'm telling you is that the underlying fundamentals of those companies cannot justify those prices and won't be able to justify them in the future. At some point, they'll be dealing with a margin compression. They'll probably get ugly. So if you're playing those stocks, just know it. Just know you're playing with fire. Okay, bottom line. And the thing that worries me is this run-up, that's everything that's been, that's what's driven up the indexes. Now, there is a distinct possibility that value is about ready to rally. We see some signs of that. So maybe value is going to catch up. And that's what we've been telling our clients. Look, we feel really good either way. A, we're making investment decisions for the right reasons. We're not chasing fads. Okay, first and foremost, chasing performance will get you killed. You know, it's like a dog chasing a car. What happens when you catch it? It's not if, it's when. Okay, that's going to happen. Mark my words, okay? So A, we're staying disciplined. We're still looking for value. We're approaching looking at dividends and cash flow and balance sheets, all the things that nobody really cares about right now, okay? And I think it's a great spot to do that, and here's why. I don't think, and again, I don't know, don't take this to the bank, don't trade on this, but I don't think that this market advance can keep going unless we start getting participation from the value side of it, okay, the more normal side of it. So now, that being said, if this market's going to head back down, it won't be value that gets rocked. It's going to be these high flyers that have these, guys, the valuations on this stuff, you might be all excited. You might say, Zach, you're a stick in the mud. You don't know. It's a new era. All that being said, I'm just telling you, it makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense. Just know if you're investing in those things, you're playing with fire. Okay. Now that's, hey, look, they could double from here. They could, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, know that you're gambling at this point. That's what you're doing. And so, but I like this. I love the value proposition. I think for us to move substantially higher on the indexes, you're going to have to get broader participation. If this market's about ready to roll over and flip, which it has. Now, see, we're bumping up against all-time highs. All-time highs are at 2940 on the S&P. We're at 2890 today. Last three times we got up to these levels, we failed. Okay, so maybe this one's the golden one. Who knows? What I'm saying is if it rolls over, I think that high price stuff's going to get rocked. If it keeps advancing, I think value is a great place to play because the beginning of this year, like I said earlier, we've had this long stretch of underperformance for value stocks. Should be no news to anybody that's heard this show before. Okay, that we've had a crescendo now, kind of a blow off top, if you will, of underperformance for value, which is why our clients in that value portfolio are calling, Zach, is there something wrong? What's going on? We're way underperforming the market. And I just say, hey, it's two quarters. Just sit tight. We're going to either play a lot of catch up, which there's some signs that that could be the case, or this thing's going to turn the other way. All the stuff that's been driving the index is going to get crucified. Now, could there be another outcome? Sure. But it looks pretty binary at this point. Like I said, I just, you can't get these things to keep driving the market up. You got to get some broader participation for these markets to make new highs. So that's going to be definitely something to watch out for. And if you're playing that IPO game, look, there's plenty to pick from. I mean, there MongoDB is another one of them. Zoom Technologies. We already talked about Beyond Meat, CrowdStrike.com. It's just so. Look, I'm not saying it's the same thing. What I am saying is that it is so strikingly similar to the late 90s. It's pretty amazing. Now, the crazy thing about the late 90s is it ran for a while, right? I mean, it you know, so this could last. But don't be gamblers, guys. Be risk managers. Long time we know what works. And the problem is clients, especially late into these moves, they get obsessed about watching the market. They get obsessed about quarter-to-quarter movements. Remember, your retirement is not predicated on what you make this quarter or next. It's predicated on how your portfolio does over the next 10 years. And what we know for absolute certainty is to get the best result over the next 10 years, you will have periods of time where you underperform. It's the way it works. You got to accept that. Okay? Because getting myopically focused on the popular stuff, the stuff that's on fire, chasing this stuff, that's what gets people staring at 80 to 90% losses like they had in 99. Okay, stick with your plan. And if you don't have one, call us, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Okay, now, moving along, something really interesting, and this dovetails right into this conversation. About 2 years ago, we ran a show, and I made up a word. I coined a word. That's how you say it, you know, if you're an academic, right? You coined it. You're a wordsmith. Maybe somebody said it before I did, but the way I described it was Amazoning. And I talked about the Amazoning effect that I thought we would see in the marketplace. And that is exactly what's happened. When you look at these companies, what is driving the growth of these companies? Or the growth of their share price? Why are these share prices going ballistic? And in case you don't know, it is not normal for a stock to go up 300 or 400% in the first 30 days of trading after an IPO. It is not normal for every stock that comes out in an IPO to be up 80 to 100% the first trading day. These are not normal things. You expect to see a pop of some kind. But this is just momentum. Okay, now, there's always a level of truth to these things. And I think that's kind of the thing that people miss. You know, it's not like people just lose their mind and start throwing money at ridiculous companies at ridiculous valuations. There's a move to it. What is it? I think it's the fulfillment of what we were talking about 2 years ago, the Amazoning of the market. Because what do all these companies have in common? They all have really good revenue growth, especially in the environment that we've been in economically for the last 10 years. You know, these companies are putting up 30, 40, 50, 60% revenue growth, which is really impressive, right? But remember, if we're not worried about making profit, if we can sell product at a loss, then it's really easy to grow revenue. Josh Brown, who I don't agree with very often, I think he's a smart guy, and no knock on him whatsoever. I shouldn't say that. I do sometimes, don't. Look, whatever. That's not important. He put out a really good piece recently that I read kind of in this line. Now, he was more on the side of it. The piece came off, and for those of you that don't know, Josh Brown is on CNBC every single day. You can see him on there. Smart guy. It seemed like he was arguing more from the "this time it's different" kind of thing. And I completely disagree with him. But and maybe he wasn't, but that was kind of my impression from the piece. But he addressed this same issue. He didn't call it the Amazoning of the market, but he talked about the whole revenue growth without profits. And maybe this is the new, you know, this is the new paradigm, and this is the way things will work from now. And I, like I said, I'm highly suspect. But one of the reasons behind this is these all follow the Amazon model. And if you listen to all these companies, Tesla fans, Zoom Tech, listen to them all. They're all going to talk about, they're all going to bring up comparisons of Amazon. Okay? Well, here's the problem. The reason that Amazon was so successful using that model is because no one else was. Right? The reason it works so well for Amazon was because they were still in the old paradigm of companies and investors focusing on earnings. And they were the ones that were taking those earnings and redeploying them back in the business. And that did a couple things for them. Think about the money that they saved in income taxes over the last 10 to 15 years. It's massive because they took those profits that most companies would return to shareholders by way of dividends or stock buybacks or whatever, and they invested in the company. Okay? Well, now everybody else is trying to use that model. And why? Well, think about it. If you're a CEO running a company and you just, all you're worried about is revenue growth, you don't have to produce profit, that makes things a lot easier. And if you need capital, you can access it right now at record low interest rates, and investors will throw cash at you. Why? Because you've got 40 or 50% revenue growth. So it's kind of like building a business under the premise of we're going to sell $100 bills for $90. And we're going to have incredible revenue growth, and we're going to fill in that gap, that profit gap, with investor capital and investor money. So this might be too strong a word, but it's kind of like a Ponzi scheme. You know, it as long as that cycle is reinforced, as long as investors are willing to throw money at this kind of stuff, theoretically, it can keep rolling. But at some point, they're going to have to show the profits. And I don't think that that's ever going to happen. It's not going to be a repeat of Amazon. And why is that? Well, you got to look at the main driver of these things. So one of the reasons these companies are able to grow revenue so fast is, like we already said, they're not focused on profit. And that makes it much easier to run a business. I mean, I envy them. I mean, it's wish we had that same dynamic. But the other reason why, The other reason why they're able to grow revenue so fast is the vast majority of these companies are web-based. Now, there's other companies that aren't web-based that are going with them, and that's just kind of what you see in a mania, right? Anything that's got some kind of growth story, just boom, everybody's just up 200%, 300% in 3 weeks. Fine, buy it. It's going higher. It's going, you know, even nobody pays attention to the underlying valuations anymore until they will. It'll come back, but it's just that's not the environment we're in. And it's important. If you want to play that stuff, fine, but just know what you're playing with, okay? Don't try to make an argument out of it. When you're buying things at 30, 40, 50 times sales, there is not a logical, you could be proven right, right? It's like flipping a coin. But don't lie to yourself. Know what you're doing, okay? You're playing with fire. It doesn't mean you're going to get burned. You do it long enough, you will. But, you know, there's people making money on it right now. So, hey. Good luck to them. Not with my money. I wouldn't even do it with your money. I wouldn't do it with anybody's money. But, you know, it's neither here nor there. But the other big reason why the vast majority of these companies are web-based is because they can scale globally so much faster than traditional businesses were able to. Well, again, that's used as a strength of theirs, okay? Here's the problem. If you've got a business that doesn't really have proprietary technology, which a lot of these don't, maybe a small piece of it is proprietary, but a lot of this stuff is just, you know, one company's twist on cloud computing, you know? That's a very easy business to imitate, all right? And their competitors can scale overnight just as fast as they did. And here's the other thing. If you're not worried about profits, what's the number one way you're going to take market share away from somebody? You're going to do by lowering your prices. So rather than these companies being Amazons, rather than these companies being future profit machines and cash machines and throwing out profit, I actually think that the odds on are from where I'm sitting looking at it today. I think the odds on favorite scenario to play out is that these companies will end up being less valued than most because they will face much higher competition. They will have much shorter shelf lives. I think that they will have unending margin pressure and they'll have completely unrealistic expectations from shareholders. And at some point, this free, cheap, historically cheap capital that they're all funding, you know, that is flowing into them now because they're hot, that's going to stop. And now investors are going to be staring at the reality of it. Yeah, they got a company that's got $100 billion market cap, but it's burning $6 or $7 billion in cash every year. So, you know, and in true to form, and this is what makes markets. This is how they work. I think that they'll end up being less profitable and less enduring companies than ever before because they don't have a moat. If you're taking on a traditional business, you know, let's even use one that's out of style, right? A retailer like Nordstrom's. If you're in the old days, that required an intense amount of capital and all these different things. You had to open stores over here. You know, just the scale of that was protection for that business enough, right? That it protected the business. You had to buy real estate. You had to get employees working in the stores. These guys can do it much faster. It's more efficient. The problem is no one's looking at the downside of that business structure. And it doesn't make it bad. It's not. It's a good development. But the downside is that it's much easier to get taken, you know, to have somebody run past you. It's much easier for three or four different competitors to let you jump in there and prove the premise. And then look at how many companies out there right now are doing these mail order boxes, right? Like a Stitch Fix or a Hot Look or all these different places that do that. I think there's another one called Box or Trunk Club, something like that, right? I can't remember the first one to market, but within 2 years, you've got 14, 15 of them, right? Now they're all competing against each other, right? So, look, I don't know which one wins out, and which one wins out will probably end up being a pretty successful business, but here's the problem. They're all priced as if they're all going to win out, and that's not going to happen. And so, again, the mania just keeps feeding itself until it doesn't, and we'll just have to wait and see until it, you know, until it dies down or till that enthusiasm drops. But these are real issues, and I think it's going to end, and it's just poetic justice. This is what markets do to people. The very reasons why everybody's so excited about this, the very reasons why they're bidding these stocks up to ridiculous, ridiculous levels are going to be the same reasons that inhibit these companies from actually growing into mature companies and being actual cash generating entities, which do not forget, as an investor, that's the only way you get paid. Profits pay investors, not revenue growth, at a loss. And if you don't think CEOs know this, if you don't think they're structuring businesses to take advantage of this right now, you're naive. No one's worried about profit. No one's worried about, it's get it out there, get it to market. We're going to make a ton of money on the IPO. We'll unload the stock on the unsuspecting public and we're all going to be rich. Now, they may not, that might be a little bit too negative of me to look at it out. And I don't think they're all sitting around having that conversation. I can guarantee you some of them are. I can also guarantee you there will be frauds uncovered in this. I can also guarantee you, I can't guarantee you this, but I would strongly bet we're not done. Because chances are this is going to run to a maximization point where it sucks in almost everybody. You just can't take the pain of missing out at the party any longer. And everybody's going to end up on one side of the boat, which I think we're fairly close to. You know, I'm hearing pros capitulate, saying that we may not ever have another recession again. Pros, guys managing billions of dollars. They're throwing in the white towel, or excuse me, waving the white flag, throwing in the towel, saying, all right, you know, you got to join the party. We got to put up numbers. Again, remember, you're not a hedge fund. You're preparing for retirement. You're preparing to finance the rest of your life, and keep that in mind. What happens next quarter or 2 quarters from now, or even a year from now, does not determine the success of your investment portfolio and the rest of your life. Performance over the next 10 and 20 years does. We must think long term, guys. For that, you got to properly manage your risk. You need to have plenty of upside, but you need to have downside protection. You need to lower your fees. Fees are the only guaranteed part of a portfolio, right? You also need upside, because we could be staring at significant inflation down the road. How do you do all that? Well, we've got a really good way. Got a great model that will actually give you more equity upside participation. So if markets go up, you'll continue to make more than you are now, but with more downside protection and at a fraction of the cost. If that sounds interesting to you, which it should, it's kind of the name of the game of investing. Give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Go to bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. Download our white paper. If you don't want to call us for a review, we can do a review over the phone. But if you don't want to call us, you can email us. We can do correspondence over email. We can meet you. We can get you our free booklet. You guys know the drill. Anyway, let's get to our interview with Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. I hope you guys enjoy it. Have a great weekend, and we will see you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach uncover the truth about the financial markets with simple and honest advice to help you plan for retirement. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss, and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor. Many people with near or over $1 million in assets will mistakenly pay more in taxes in a long-term care situation than it would have cost them to set up an insurance plan to pay for the care needed. Due to recent changes in the Pension Protection Act, these new asset-based plans guarantee a tax-free benefit for long-term care and pay your estate back with interest if you never use it. But most importantly, it's about having a plan. All your children have to do is carry out your wishes, and you're not a burden on them. That's why I love the advice my wife and I got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. Brian's asset-based class is Friday, June 21st in Bellevue. This class is aimed at individuals and couples who have accumulated close to or more than $1 million in assets and may be considering self-funding their long-term care costs in the future. Learn why that is not the best idea. Seating will be limited for this special asset-based class, June 21st in Bellevue. Reserve your spot right now, 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us and being with us. And we got a special guest with us today for a macroeconomic update. And for those of you that don't know what macroeconomics means, it's the big picture, right? I've always been a big fan of macroeconomics, just because when you understand what's happening at a micro level, it's much easier to make sense of what's happening at a micro level with an individual company or an individual country. and it's essential. It's like context. And our guest today is, in my opinion, one of the best out there at putting that context to it. So without further ado, I want to introduce Chase Taylor, a Pinecone Macro Research. Chase, hey, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on again.
Well, hey, yeah, I love your stuff and wanted to say before we even got started, they can find you at pineconemacroresearch.com, right? I didn't screw that up.
Pineconemacro.com.
Okay, but I did screw it up, see? Pineconemacro.com. And then on Twitter, at your Twitter handle, at pineconemacro, right? At pineconemacro.
Yep, you got it.
Yep. So at Twitter, at pineconemacro. But anyway, great stuff. And Chase has got one of the best deals in the business. You can sign up for his weekly macroeconomic updates through his website. We are a client of his, so it lets you know that there are real professionals out there using this guy's service. So I'd encourage you to go to the website and get some and some deep stuff too. Chase, one of the things I love about what you guys do is you're looking at the macro, but you do it with kind of a bend on micro. And I want to get into exactly what I mean without giving it away. But when I'm sitting there reading a macroeconomic research piece and I start reading about armyworms, I love the meld of that because, you know, some people would call that a micro detail, but it has a big effect on the macro side of things. And I want to transition right into that because you've been writing a lot about China. I think that the world right now economically is focused on China, rightly so. And I want to get an update of what is going on with China, kind of give us the lay of the land. It will start there. The food issue. I love that piece you put out about the you know, the army worms and all that other kind of stuff. Kind of give us a summation of that whole scenario and why you think that that is something that we need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, it is kind of a micro detail, what's kind of going on with agriculture in China. But at the same time, when that starts to feed into inflation in China, then it can start to become a bit of a macro, you know, input. So there's kind of four or five different things happening all at once to China from an agricultural perspective. They have African swine flu that's taking out millions of their pigs. You know, they're the biggest pig producer in the world, the biggest consumer of pork in the world. And all throughout the region, there's been this African swine flu issue. And pork prices have skyrocketed, which is bringing up, you know, food inflation and overall inflation in China. But, and a lot of people know that one, and it's kind of been on the news a little bit lately. But in addition to that, like you mentioned, the armyworms, they have what's called fall armyworms, and they eat crops. So you have this kind of protein issue where pork is getting hit, but you also have the issue with grains where armyworms are eating up, you know, whatever it be, wheat, corn, sugar, all these different kinds of crops. And they can take down, you know, a lot of acres really fast. And they're very difficult to stop. China's trying to use some emergency use of pesticides and even trying to, like, grow stink bugs to use to counter them. But kind of remains to be seen whether the worms will get up into the north where the big corn belt in China is. And if that does happen, a lot of experts do think they will get up to that corn belt and they can start really taking out corn, then it becomes a macro input because corn gets more expensive, pushes up inflation, which makes it a little more difficult for China to, you know, ease a lot of policy because they already have big inflation from that. But at the same time, you know, in the trade war, kind of the biggest weakness the U.S. has had politically, especially, is for China to go after imports of agricultural commodities from the U.S. Can hurts the farmers in America, and farmers, you know, they swing pretty heavy politically. They punch higher than their weight, if you will, politically in the U.S. And that's kind of been hurting Trump a bit. But you know, whenever all your hogs get sick and die, you have to buy more hogs from the U.S. And if a lot of your corn dies, you have to buy more corn from the U.S. even if you don't want to. So it kind of has a big macro input on the trade war, but also on the inflation side. And two other ones, they're having some bird flu issues with chicken within China. And then there's mad cow disease in Brazil that's kind of hurting their beef imports. So that's kind of, you know, the four horsemen of the agricultural apocalypse in China right now.
Wow. Well, the other thing that caught my eye about that was, you know, you don't want to get too hyperbolic about these things, obviously, because that doesn't tend to help investment returns. At the end of the day, that's what we're here for. But the interesting thing about that whole setup to me is all of these things are going to be negative inputs when it comes to the valuation of the yuan, correct?
Yes, and it kind of depends, but like I would say the yuan is more impacted by the trade war at large than probably, you know, these agricultural inputs, but at the same time, you know, it is going to feed into what China does policy wise. So
that's the interesting thing to me is just, you know, but bottom line, we haven't seen the Chinese economy under this duress from this many pressure points at really any time in the last 23, 25 years. And in the middle, you know, considering the timing of all this, right in the middle of the trade war, and obviously that's probably the biggest chunk of it, like you said. But still, that's a lot of pressure. I'm sitting here wondering if that pressure makes a trade deal less or more likely. What are your thoughts on that?
I think more likely. You know, it looks like China walked away from the deal recently. And there was rumors coming out being written about, you know, that President Xi was kind of on board, but that he was sort of overruled by, you know, other members of the party, be it Politburo or others within China. So, but, you know, last time I was on your show, I talked a lot about the middle income trap. China really has to transition their economy away from, you know, just old school manufacturing and infrastructure and really go up the value chain with, you know, higher technology, stuff like that, so that their people become richer. Like the per capita income is pretty low in China, and they really need to ratchet that up before their demographics get really, really bad. So they're in this really important time period right now where they really have to do well and transition their economy. You know, they need their people to be rich so that consumers can do well. So if all of a sudden your grocery bill is skyrocketing, it's really hard for consumers to do well. And you know, the trade war means factories are leaving every day to go to, you know, Mexico, to Eastern Europe, to Vietnam, and that's something that is putting immense pressure on China. So I think the pressure on China to come to some sort of agreement with the U.S. relatively quickly, I think the pressure is immense. I think if they fight back too long against this trade war, that they will not escape the middle income trap. And you know, all the predictions, you know, we've all been reading for many years about China overtaking the U.S. and all these different ways, and I think this won't happen. They'll be much like Japan and the Soviet Union, where it looks like they're going to pass the U.S., but then they just can't.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I'm starting to think about, because, you know, I haven't really changed courses on this because I think it's still a high probability. But you know, just 6 months ago, you were kind of looking at least I was on my part of it and sitting there thinking to myself, you know, I don't see China capitulating in any major fashion. You know, unless they get, obviously, if they get a favorable deal, but I don't see them capitulating unless, or excuse me, prior to the 2020 election, because I just thought, okay, you know, I, you know, if they think Trump's out of there, then they're probably assuming that whoever fills into that gap is going to be, you know, an easier negotiator and kind of give them an easy path. I would certainly agree with that assertion, whether right or wrong. Again, not saying that Trump's right for driving a hard line. I just, you know, I would think that would be a correct assertion on their point or on their part. But it's not it's looking like when you bring up all these pressures again on the agricultural side now, not just the trade side and the economic side, you know, they're putting up some of the worst numbers we've seen out of them in 20 years. You know, waiting till the 2020 elections, that might be too long. And you know, whether or not you think that China is, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread and that Trump's unfair, or whether you side with Trump, whatever, it's sort of immaterial. Bottom line is, this is the biggest debt experiment, the biggest debt house of cards we've ever seen. And that situation, you look at those combined pressures on all sides. I mean, this, it could. Again, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, but one of our thoughts and one of our fears is, because of the precarious situation they're in due to their massive internal debt, this, under these types of pressures, this could come unwound pretty quickly, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, if they are betting on having an easier time, you know, possibly after this election, I think it may be misguided. You know, I think we've seen recently Joe Biden's having political problems because he has been pretty pro-China in the past. And I think the institutional inertia, you know, in the U.S., whether it be State Department, Defense Department, Commerce, like kind of across the government, the bureaucrats that tend to stay around, I think they've become more and more, you know, hawkish against China. And those people, a lot of them will be around in the next administration, regardless of who it is. So that may be a miscalculation on their part. You know, and I'm sure it would be marginally better if a Democrat were to win in 2020, but at the same time, you know, the amount of time between now and then, the amount of factories that are going to leave, you know, China is going to be significant. And that creates a lot of unemployment and, you know, social instability and financial instability in China that will be very difficult to overcome.
Yeah, which will be interesting to see the way Xi responds, just because, I mean, Xi got his lifetime appointment? Was it 2 years ago?
Indeed, and it's controversial. I don't think too many people agree with me, but I don't think he'll be in power, you know, a decade from now, personally. But
I would tend to agree with you because I'm a giant China bear. I just kind of see it as, you know, I kind of see the whole China situation sort of like giving, you know, teenage boys, like 13 or 14 year old boys, you know, a couple bottles of nitroglycerin, right? You can tell them to be careful all you want. I'm just, something bad's gonna happen, right? I mean, just, you just play the odds. And, you know, I just can't structurally see. And again, I'm not saying China's going to go away not saying anything like that. I just can't see the extension of this much longer. I mean, this is just it's just crazy.
Absolutely.
Okay. What else do we what else are you looking at? What else do we see in the world? What's happening here domestically? You know this. You and I have spent a lot of time off air talking about this, but I interface with retail clients every day of the week, our own clients and our own prospective clients. The overwhelming sentiment is just that things couldn't be better here in the U.S., that we're rocking and rolling. And it's, you know, we're making America great again. a little tongue in cheek there. And I don't say that to be pejorative toward Trump or Trump's party. You guys know, if you listen to the show, it's not at all what I'm trying to do. What I am saying is, you know, my personal view on it is that expectations and what people think is going on is sort of outpaced the reality. But tell me if I'm wrong. And then not just domestically here, what other things are you keeping your eye on? And what are we seeing happening around the world?
Yeah, so what I'm finding really interesting right now is financial markets, you know, stocks are, you know, and they're still, you know, whatever it is, 3% from the highs. So they're doing fine. But, you know, the bond market has really signaled, yeah, panic lately. It's you know, yields have been plummeting. Traders are, you know, factoring in about 3 rate cuts over the next 6 months, not even 6 months. So you're looking at maybe, you know, rates falling that much further, maybe another 75 basis points. And when I look at the economy, there's plenty to be bearish about. You know, you can find plenty of things that are saying, you know, this is the worst since 2008. And that creates a visceral response for people, because 08 was a crisis and it was really painful. But you can also find a lot of things in the economy that are still doing really well. And I think there's enough things in the economy going really well. Inflation's still right about 2%. Retail sales, you know, numbers just came out this morning. They were pretty good. Confidence levels amongst businesses and consumers are pretty good. I don't see any need for a major policy response from the Fed anytime soon. And, you know, I think if we don't get massive cuts, whether it's two or three cuts the rest of the year, that's going to create some issues in the market. I think it's just rates have kind of sold off too much lately. So I think, you know, while the average retail client might be a little too bullish, I think the average Wall Streeter is a little too bearish on the economy. You know, now if the Fed comes out and, you know, disappoints everyone and isn't going to cut rates a bunch, then, you know, that will likely hurt stocks. But yeah, the biggest thing I'm seeing right now is there's too much pessimism on the overall economy from Wall Street. And I think that's going to kind of go the other way here in the next few months.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. That's kind of been the way that we've been describing it to people. You know, there's all this bearish talk about a recession. You know, I mean, look, there's plenty of things to be concerned about that point to that direction at some point in the near future. Yet at the same time, you got to wait for the data to get there. You know, the other thing that we've talked a lot about, the inverted yield curve has gotten a lot of hype. The only question I've got is when you look at, you know, the world's never had, what are we up to? Is it 10 or $12 trillion now of negatively trading sovereign debt? And, you know,
yeah, it's going up every day.
Oh yeah. And then balance sheets, you know, of these central banks. I don't know the impact that has on the yield curve. I can't believe there isn't some. And you know, so what I'm saying is that, yeah, the yield curve inverting, I don't think is a good sign, but it may not be what it has been in the past. And truthfully, I think you could point to a lot of economic indicators that way, just because we've never been in an expansion before, A, this long, but B, when the main driver of said expansion were central banks. So, you know, again, if our job is to get it right and not just preach or be what you've termed a financial justice warrior, if we're not being financial justice warriors, then I think we got to take those things with a grain of salt. My biggest concern has been the rally that we've seen in equities so far this year. It may be justified at some point, but there's very little data to back up. You know, look, the other side of it is you've got two quarters in a row now where we've got lower earnings than we did over the previous year. So, I mean, you know, that's not an economy going great guns. I mean, it's comparatively speaking, I guess it's, you know, kind of the best in class at this point. But, it's not, I think you put it pretty well. It's not impending doom, but, you know, I think bidding up all these IPOs 300-400% in the first month of trading seems a little bit excessive. But anyway, going on to the rest of the world then, what else are you seeing? What is there anything out there that you're looking at where you're sitting there kind of scratching your head going, man, nobody's really paying enough attention to this, and I think this is an issue or a potential issue?
You know, domestically, I feel like what's going on with going back to agriculture prices has been kind of significant lately. You know, agriculture has been getting killed for years, and all of the flooding in the Midwest has really, you know, hurt planting this season. We're looking at the worst data on record for corn planting in some parts of the country. So I think, you know, prices of corn, wheat, sugar, these kinds of things are starting to really bottom out and see some pretty big moves. You know, it's not a big global macro thing, but it's something I find important. And also Europe, you know, we've seen inflation and inflation expectations fall some in the U.S., but they're at all-time lows in Europe. And we're kind of starting to challenge the all-time lows on yields across Europe. And you're seeing kind of a rolling banking crisis throughout Europe that, for whatever reason, no one's paying attention to. You know, if you look at the charts of the biggest banks across Europe, whether they be in Spain, Germany, Italy, you're looking at just brutal charts of, you know, they can't make money when rates are at zero. Same with Japan. Japan is sort of a keystone to the world when it comes to their capital markets and their banking system, and it's really struggling. They can't make money with negative rates, and I think the impact of of negative rates across the world on banks is something that just isn't really getting enough attention and could cause, you know, a lot of significant pain in the next few years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. The other thing is you got a world, you know, and there's, to be fair, there's been more talk about it certainly in the last year. But you've got a world that is, you know, it seems to me like central banks just don't think that we could do a 4-hour show on this, you know, just being singularly focused on generating inflation. I think one of the interesting things about that, and I've been saying this for years, which doesn't make it right, but my own opinion has been, look, you got the world, you got the world's, you know, bankers and everybody in the world singularly focused on deflation being the fear, and they are infinitely more capable of battling deflation than they are inflation. Inflation's sort of a one-way street. And then when you look at the debt loads that the world is carrying around, the number one way to fight inflation is by raising rates. And, you know, they're kind of pinned to the mat there. Meaning, absolutely. Everybody brings up Paul Volcker. I've heard somebody the other day, some strategist say, look, I think we're overcooking this. You know, Paul Volcker beat inflation down and there's no reason to think that we can't. And I sat there and I went, well, Paul Volcker wasn't dealing with 110% debt to GDP and a world, you know, in a macroeconomic world that was at 340% debt to GDP, you know, at record low rates, corporate bond markets at all time highs. So I've kind of looked at this and thought, you know, when inflation becomes an issue, which it will at some point, that's kind of when this whole thing's going to really start to shake and get a little bit scary. And what it sounds like from what you're saying is we're seeing a lot of potential inflationary pressure starting to build up. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think in some small ways. I don't expect inflation to really take off until fiscal policy takes off, which I think, you know, is definitely going to happen. We'll get some version of modern monetary theory where the government really starts to spend. And I know, like, just looking at it now, it seems like it's already crazy and it's already been crazy over the last decade, and it has. But the level of crazy is going to get taken up, you know, in order of magnitude. And one of the reasons, you know, quantitative easing and the money printing didn't cause inflation as so many people, including myself, originally, you know, expected is there has to be somebody to lend that money to. And after 2008, you know, the average household, the average consumer kind of went into their shell and they've been deleveraging actually ever since. So the, you know, debt to GDP for, you know, your average folks actually went down a lot since 08 and it's kind of stayed on the floor, you know, whereas the government spent a lot. Well, I think they're going to realize if they want real inflation, they're going to have to spend, you know, as a government, because, you know, your average business and your average person isn't really that interested. So there's no one to lend the money to for the banks. But if the government steps in and spends, you know, $2 trillion deficits, $3 trillion deficits, and then the Fed just prints up that money for them, you know, eventually, then that's where your inflation is really going to come. I think we'll get cyclical, you know, inflation pressures from maybe from agricultural commodities and tariffs coming in from China, although so far that's been deflationary. But yeah, I don't expect a major spike in inflation before fiscal policy gets crazy. But I do think, you know, we'll see an uptick.
Well, I just, yeah, that one of the things that's puzzled me is you almost, and I could be way off. I'm not a monetary expert by any stretch of the imagination. But when you have this much debt around the world, and you start running to inflationary pressures, and if there's even the slightest bit of, I mean, it's kind of like, it seems to me like you're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because if inflation does creep up, I just can't see it getting out of control, because if it were to, I mean, everything would just start, I mean, the dominoes would just start falling over so fast. You know, I mean, can you imagine if some of these corporations out there, and I'm not talking anything crazy, but can you imagine if they had to start rolling their debt at a point and a half to 2 points higher than they currently got it? I mean, you would watch cash flows and margins. I mean, they'd collapse inside of a quarter, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, every, you know, debt ratchets up and then rates ratchet lower, you know, over the entire long-term debt cycle, which, you know, 80, 100 years, whatever those tend to be. And you just kind of reach to the point where you get to the floor where, you know, debt can't really go much higher and inflation can't, or, you know, rates can't go much lower. And it reaches a point where even a small spike in inflation historically becomes a major problem, like you're saying. Like, you know, if we had 5% inflation now, that's been normal through history. But what that would do now is probably, you know, take the keys away from policymakers in a lot of ways. And, we'd actually feel a lot of pain.
Yeah, I mean,
and like, yeah, all these businesses, you know, all these corporations that are, they're wildly leveraged to, you know, interest rates that are 1-2%, you know, if they have to pay 4, it's game over.
Yeah.
All the zombies, you know, go away.
Yeah, it'd be Japan Redux, you know, 1990 style. It's, boy, fascinating world and probably a pretty fun time. Certainly a target-rich environment to be a macroeconomic researcher, huh?
Absolutely. Plenty to write about.
Yeah. Plenty to write about. Well, hey, Chase, I really appreciate the update. You coming on again, and I'll be looking forward to that letter. Hey, did your new letter come out, by the way? You kind of sent me a teaser, but I didn't see it hit my inbox. Is that out?
It should be out Monday.
Okay.
If you didn't get that Monday, just let me know offline, and I'll make sure you get it.
Yeah, I'll dig. It's probably just something I looked over and didn't see in the inbox. But anyway, well, hey, great to have you on again, and we're certainly going to bug you to be on again. And have a great weekend, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
I appreciate you having me on again. Take care.
All right, Chase, take care. Anyway, that was Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. Again, you could follow him on Twitter at Pinecone Macro, and the website at pinecone macro.com. Just a great guy and a brilliant mind, and I just love the way he looks at things, does a great job analyzing from the top down, and then also showing how it filters into the small stuff. So anyway, we got to take a we got to run, actually, don't we? That's the unfortunately, we're out of time. Anyway, have a wonderful weekend. It was great to be with you guys again. And as always, if we're looking for risk management strategies, if we're looking to get a better hedge against risk in our portfolio, if we're looking to lower our costs, which everybody should, less risk, less cost. These are good things. This is what we should be aiming for. And also more upside potential. If that intrigues you, which it should, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, we can do a portfolio review right online via email. We can meet in person. We can do it over the phone. Just get another, just get a second opinion. And we'll go back and forth and show you what you've got, how it's performed. And we'll show you the portfolios we've been using, including the cost of those portfolios and how they protect you and how they've performed. And what I can tell you with certainty is we can certainly lower your cost. We can dramatically lower your exposure to risk, and we can give you greater upside potential. Again, there's no guarantees, but we can give you much greater upside potential than the standard, 60-40 stock bond portfolio. So anyway, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com, bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. Go to the podcast page. You can just Google Know Your Risk Radio at Stitcher. You can go to our iTunes page, which you can find a link to on the website. Anyway, we got to run. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
Many people with near or over $1 million in assets will mistakenly pay more in taxes in a long-term care situation than it would have cost them to set up an insurance plan to pay for the care needed. Due to recent changes in the Pension Protection Act, these new asset-based plans guarantee a tax-free benefit for long-term care and pay your estate back with interest if you never use it.
But most importantly, it's about having a plan. All your children have to do is carry out your wishes, and you're not a burden on them. That's why I love the advice my wife and I got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. Brian's asset-based class is Friday, June 21st, in Bellevue. This class is aimed at individuals and couples who have accumulated close to or more than $1 million in assets and may be considering self-funding their long-term care costs in the future. Learn why that is not the best idea. Seating will be limited for this special asset-based class, June 21st in Bellevue. Reserve your spot right now, 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com.